It's good to be together again. It was good to be apart, too. I've read 8 or 10 books in the last 4 or 5 weeks that let me re-energize for a spring series of sermons. So it's an important time to catch up on other church work that I'm always behind on by January. But I've missed you, and it's good to be back. It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It's a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. Once in a while, not often, but once in a while, a very real and powerful moment gets our attention. It breaks through all the mind-numbing manipulations of our best advertising and political geniuses and wakes us up, often rudely. It hurts, and if we will let it, it may also bring some wisdom. I love the paradox of things that hurt and bring wisdom. And my favorite statement of that paradox comes from the Greek dramatist Aeschylus from more than 2,500 years ago. Here's how he put it. Pain that cannot forget falls drop by drop upon the heart until, in our despair, there comes wisdom through the awful grace of God. I've never heard that phrase used by anyone else. The awful grace of God. Yesterday, another of those very real moments got to us. Our space shuttle Columbia exploded and disintegrated over Texas around 8 yesterday morning, less than 15 minutes before it was to land at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. Here was a crew of 7 people, an international crew, a black man, an Israeli, 2 women, one from India, a couple American Air Force pilots and doctors and scientists, different sexes, races, nationalities, and religions, all doing a job they believed in that they knew was dangerous. When we heard the news, the revelation to me was that, and you all know this, was that we all knew immediately that all these lives were equal. They were not ranked according to their ethnicity or their ideology. Perhaps that's some of the wisdom that comes through what Aeschylus called the awful grace of God. We make time in our service and in our lives now to light candles of memory or and hope, or just to sit quietly and remember who we really are and why we are really here. Yet more needs to be said. The timing of this tragedy may bring a revelation if we will let it. And I want to speak from what I think is the heart of almost every religion in the world. For our elected leaders are now preparing to invade a sovereign nation and slaughter an estimated tens of thousands of innocent civilians. Over 90% of the people killed in modern wars are civilians now. They and we try to ignore this by calling it collateral damage. And I was struck yesterday by the fact that no one called those deaths collateral damage. It would have been vulgar to do so. We showed each of their faces. We told each of their stories. We cried for the families they left behind. And we knew, as well as we know anything, that these 7 were our brothers and our sisters, members of our family. Yesterday we remembered that all the lives lost were equally precious, regardless of sex, race, religion, or nationality. Can we really now forget it again so quickly and resume our talk of unprovoked war, of using our weapons of mass destruction to destroy huge masses of our brothers and sisters in Iraq? If we are to squeeze a lesson from yesterday's tragedy, let it be to remember that all lives are equally sacred, and that war, even if it were to be an honest war, is the ultimate failure of our imagination, our leadership, and our humanity. Let us pray that those seven deaths do not go by without letting them remind us that no other people are enough different from us that we have such easy license to kill them in an unprovoked war. Those of you who were here on December 29th to hear Reverend Donald Wheat preach will remember that he said one reason that liberal religion loses out to the many more literalistic religions is because we don't have a good, clear story. Last summer, my 16-year-old niece, bright, outspoken girl, took it a step farther. She's a Christian fundamentalist. And she and my brother visited when I was in Quebec for a few days, and Morgan spent those days as though she were on an anthropological field trip studying these bizarre creatures, Unitarians. She watched them parade by at their general assembly. She thought it was a very strange tribe indeed. And then she would engage some of them in talk, you know, as a spy doing field study. And second or third day, she reported to me at lunch, she said, "Uncle Davidson, I can tell you why your religion's such a failure." I said, "Well, that'd be very useful." I said, "Please do, tell me." And she said, "It's very simple. You don't have a book." And I thought, I don't have an answer for that either. I said, "That's really good, Mo. I could say that we have a bunch of books." "No," she said, "not the same thing. You can't save the people. Go browse the library. You got to have a book. You say, there's the book, go read it, that's the end." She said, "You don't have a book, that's why your religion's such a miserable failure." And I said, I appreciate that, and I give up. And I still had to pay for the lunch. There's certainly something to it. I think that there is a story, but I don't think that the story, by which I mean, what's the true story of where we came from, who we are, what life is like, and what we do about it? I think there are true stories to that. But I don't think they've ever all been put together into one powerful myth or story. A story of creation, of human nature, of the nature of good and evil, of the human condition, of prescriptions for what do we do, how do we answer the questions we've been asking forever. I want to take Don Wheat's challenge seriously this month, though not my niece's. I'm not sure what to do about hers. But I want to take Don Wheat's challenge seriously and offer four sermons to address some of these topics of what is the true story of where we came from, who we are, what's wrong, and what do we do about it. I think we do have a coherent story. We certainly have a lot of facts on our side. But when it comes to a showdown between facts and myths, myths win every time. Even our scientists can only really communicate with the rest of us by telling us stories. The story of the Big Bang, the story of evolution. They may not be interesting stories, but they're stories. The kinds of stories people really yearn for have to help us find answers to a lot of these very basic questions, though. Who am I? Who am I supposed to be? How am I supposed to live? How am I supposed to treat other people and live with others? And finally, after I'm gone, Does anything remain in any way as a testimony to the fact that once I lived, once I loved, and once I used my life to serve things I thought were precious? We've asked those questions as long as we've been here. Hundreds of thousands of books have been written on them. Millions of people have had answers, some profound, some foolish, mostly a mixture of the two. Only a fool would try to address them in four sermons. So let's begin. Most religions start with a creation story. In the beginning. Non-theistic religions don't seem to. They don't seem to care about a creation story. Buddhism, Taoism, Confucianism don't need creation stories. But theistic religions generally have one, and we all know that all three of the main Western religions have the same creation story found in the Bible. I'll talk about the creation story from the Bible later. First, I want to back off to talk about creation stories. They're very powerful. We shouldn't underestimate them. They tell us what we're made of, and they tell us where the real power lies and how we would get it. They tell us so many things that we buy without even knowing we've been taught them. Creation stories are terribly important. If you know someone's creation story, you probably know their salvation story, even if they don't, because the two are mirror images of each other. Now, that point alone is probably worth half a dozen sermons. You might think of asking about your own story, what you think you're made of, where you think your power is, how you think you would get it, what you think it would take for you to feel okay or whole. But for now, let's just think about the creation story, about how everything came to be, life, the universe, us, everything. Forget about religious myths for now. We'll bring them in later. Now let's just talk about the things that most of us believe about how things came to be. For most people in our society, the answers come from our sciences. They may not have interesting stories, but they have answers that we think are true. About 15 billion years ago, we're told by our scientific storytellers, it all started off with a bang. It all exploded and expanded faster than we would have any idea how to imagine. But in the beginning, we are told, everything in the universe was all together in a little ball. That means that everything in the universe, including us, is made, literally, of stardust. Our birthplace was literally in the stars. And it means that everything everywhere, the whole shebang, is made of the same stuff. And this seems to be true. So far, on our planet, we've discovered 109 different chemical elements. And all the information we've gathered through our space probes and spectrographic analysis of images from the Hubble Space Telescope and so on, it hasn't found any others. We're made of the same stuff that everything else is. We are all related, even at the atomic level, with everything that exists everywhere. That's an amazing creation story. Here on Earth, life evolved in ways we're just beginning to understand. I don't think we've got it down yet. But again, it's a case that very few materials make up the warp and the weft of all life on Earth. It's a very simple picture. All DNA, from ours down to the DNA of bacteria, is made up of just four different building blocks. That's amazing to me. I'll mispronounce all four. Their letters are AGCT, and they stand for something like adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine. That isn't really what they are, that's just what somebody named them. So it's okay if you mispronounce it. I have to go off track. It reminds me of a story I've always loved about a Russian rustic who came in from the boonies in Russia and once took a tour of a great astronomical site where they got to look through a telescope and had someone explain to him what they were looking at on the stars. And afterwards, somebody said to him, "Well, were you pretty impressed with that?" And he said, "I was very impressed." And he said, you were impressed with all the different stars you can see?" He said, "No, that wasn't so impressive. What I don't understand is how they knew their names." So maybe I mispronounced them. Maybe those aren't really their names. But there are four building blocks that we seem pretty sure of. And we've decided to call them A, G, C, and T. And when they combine into DNA, each one is always and only attracted to only one other. They don't just kind of made up randomly. The adenine always links with the thymine, and the guanine always connects to the cytosine. Very simple building blocks and very simple rules for all life on Earth. Those things have formed millions of shapes, millions of kinds of life, but the whole shebang is made of the same stuff. Animals, plants, all intimately related, made of combinations of the same four building blocks. All life on Earth is part of the same family. That's not poetry, that's fact. That's the true creation story. That much we know. We can demonstrate, we can prove that. And it's a cycle. We live by killing and eating other life, plant or animal. We kill other life and eat it, and that's how we live. Then when we die, our bodies are broken down, and they become the bodies of plants, and the plants become the bodies of other plants and animals. And that cycle has gone on from the start of life and will go on till the end of life. It's nature's great plan, reducing life to its basic components and recycling it over and over again. I've heard modern Hindus use these facts to say, "You see, reincarnation, we told you all along." I'm not trying to sell you on reincarnation, which I think is an imaginative picture that can expand our consciousness and our awareness and our sense of interrelatedness, and that's a good thing. But I am trying to sell you on our most honest story of creation, which is that we are deeply linked with all life on Earth, all the way down. That's our deepest identity. And if you think about it, that carries powerful suggestions for how we should think about ourselves and each other and how we should treat one another. And these are suggestions you find mirrored in most of the world's great religions. It's not a coincidence. The great poets and sages of the world's great religions seemed to intuit this interconnection thousands of years ago. They may not have known the names of those four building blocks or the names of the stars, but they intuited the interrelatedness of it all, and they built it into their myths. Native Americans had rituals like the buffalo dance. It's an amazing dance. If you know some of the Plains Indians, if you've ever been up to Montana and you've seen those little short bluffs where the Indians used to herd the buffalo over the bluff so they could kill enough in one hunt to feed the whole tribe. And somewhere along the way, it occurred to them that they were making withdrawals from the bank of life and needed to make deposits back into it. And I don't know how the story evolved, but it's a wonderful story about some buffalo who married an Indian princess and then told her that what you're doing is upsetting the balance of life, and if you are going to take our lives to feed you, you have to do something to help make the circle whole again. And so the buffalo in the myth taught the Blackfeet Indians the buffalo dance, and after big buffalo hunts, they would do this dance, and through the dance, they were trying to ritually say, "We want to regenerate the buffalo spirits on Earth and help recreate more buffalo lives, because we know that we've taken something from you, and we owe it back." Now, you can call that simple mythology, but it's profound awareness of the fact that we are intimately connected to all life on Earth. I've read stories of other Indians who go out to chop a tree down, to hollow out a canoe or to make poles for their teepees, and they sit and they talk to the tree first. And they tell it why they have to cut it down. And they tell it about their family and the people who are going to benefit from this. And they're connecting with life that they felt intimately related to. That's poetry. But it's true poetry. It's poetry grounded in the real creation story of how things came to be and how interrelated we all are. This goes way back. The ancient Neanderthals in China had burial sites that were stunning when they were discovered. Here are people somewhere between 100 and 200,000 years ago who would bury their dead by putting them in a fetal position, then digging a womb-shaped grave in the earth, in Mother Earth, and they would bury their dead facing east toward the direction of the rising sun. A woman after the first service, who's an anthropologist, said that this same custom has also been found among the ancient Peruvians and among some people on Mali. Now, they didn't leave written instructions for what they were doing, but it looks like they are entrusting their beloved dead to Mother Earth, returning them to her womb, curled up like babies, ready to be reborn as the rising sun is reborn. Here's an intuitive expression of people's feeling that we are part of this place. We are born from it. This is our natural home. We're absolutely connected all the way down. The true creation story tells us that we're not strangers here, that this is our home. We are one with everything, and everything is one with us. The ancient Greek myth of creation expresses this same truth in a different way by saying that in the beginning, heaven and earth mated, and everything was born from that union. Now we're not only stardust, we are made up completely of the gods. Our parentage is divine all the way back to the beginning. That's the true creation story put into poetry, into myths. It's good poetry. I remember that one of the most famous prayers we have in Western religion, and there are versions of it in other religions, are the prayer that things be on earth as they are in heaven. We may be made of earth, but something in us feels that the earth is made of gods or made of stardust, and we want things here to reflect our regal beginnings. That's good religion. It's the real story of creation and of the creation of life on earth, that it's all stardust and we're all family. Here is a plea for universal peace and brotherhood that sings like a leitmotif through every religion I know of. The power that created the universe is within us. It's our power. And if we would remember our real creation story and our real divine origins and claim that power and act in ways that are consistent with our interrelation with everything else, what a different world it would be. That would be the world that Jesus once called the kingdom of God. The place where we treated one another as though they were all our brothers and sisters, and we would not accept any smaller or divisive definition. That's a true story, coming from a true creation story. That's good religion. Now, that's the good news. I don't want you to be too happy, so I want to bring you the bad news. And in many ways, the bad news is even more powerful and certainly a lot more dreary than the good news. It's a gigantic problem. It's one of the most important things to learn about religion, politics, sociology, psychology, anthropology, all those things. And that's that the true story has usually been kidnapped by priests, politicians, tribal rulers, and turned into a story that takes power and dignity away from people and transfers it to the priests, the politicians, the tribal chiefs, the religions. And then our job is to beg for some of it back. That's the false creation story that mostly won There's a story about this, and I'll tell you the story about this. I've read this in several different religious traditions in different versions, so it seems to be something everyone has thought of, too. You've probably heard some version of it. Here's one. The story says that in the beginning there was a spring of life. It was just right out there in the ground. Everybody could get at it. It was all free. Anybody who drank from the spring of life was nourished and fed, and that's it. You want life, you want to be fed, go drink from the spring of life. You don't need a ticket. But then, people decided, and I look out the window at that little spring we have, and I see that we decided the same thing. Said, well, you can't just leave that thing unprotected. You need to put a fence around it. You got to protect it. And then people decided, a fence really isn't enough. You need a building over it, too. Because you don't want people wandering through this thing. I mean, they might, steal it. And then you need people to guard this spring, because it's really important. And so you give them really important-looking costumes, and you give them important titles like priests and rulers and kings, and they guard the spring. And now people can't get to the spring anymore. But what they get instead are stories and dances and things that the rulers and the priests teach them that will give them a taste of what it is once rumored to have been like when people actually drank from the thing. And that's the story of religions, in admittedly a fairly small nutshell. Let's take this into the religion most of us grew up soaked in, whether it was our religion or not, the notion of Western religions, and you see how this worked. Archaeologists and biblical scholars are now fairly sure that the ancient Hebrews developed their religion and their customs from the more ancient tribe of the Canaanites, which is where they began. Scholars are now saying that there was no Egyptian chapter in ancient Hebrew religion and that there was no Moses. This was a Canaanite group that developed out of and separated itself from the other Canaanites and made a point of developing a religion and a concept of God that separated them from the religion of the Canaanites too. They were the kind of border squabbles that go on everywhere, where the people we can least stand are the people who are most like us. The Canaanite religion was a nature religion. It had a mother earth, an earth mother that created everything out of herself. That was our natural home. Perhaps it was a religion that really empowered people by saying, go drink from the spring. It's right over there. We don't know that. What we do know is that the Hebrews created a new religion in direct opposition to the Canaanite religion. They took a female creation story, and I've always thought this is very funny, and they tried to make it a male creation story. And if you back off far enough to see it that way, it's a very funny story. Think about this. When you hear a creation story that says, in the beginning, the main deity created everything out of itself, is that the story about a goddess or a god? That's a woman's story. That's a story of creation by Mother Earth. Women create things like that out of themselves, not men. So it's funny to read the Hebrew creation story about a god who now took the story of their neighbors, the Canaanites, and now creates everything all by himself. This is almost like an adolescent boy. Scholars have said that the god created by the ancient Hebrews was a projection of their tribal chiefs, and that you can tell this because it has the same powers and the same duties and responsibilities as their tribal chiefs. Why do they say that? Because tribal chiefs are the ones that set the rules for the tribe. They say, here's how you live if you're going to be in the in-group. And if you're in the in-group, you're protected. And if you don't live the way the in-group lives, you're not protected and you may well be in danger. This is the way old Yahweh did. Other scholars have shown that the covenant you find in the Old Testament between God and His chosen people was modeled directly after ancient Hittite sovereignty treaties that go back more than 4,000 years. Very ancient things. The people were expected to have no other ruler above the tribal chief. They were expected to be loyal only to him. In return for that, they got his protection, and they were punished if they disobeyed. That's the basic structure of the covenant between the ancient Hebrews and the God they created. So their male God created the whole world and all life on it all by himself. I want you to see what's happened in this creation story and what's been lost. This, I think, is the false creation story. Now, we're made out of dirt. And we stay dirt. We've got nothing sacred about us. We're dirt until this God breathes the breath of life into us and loans us life. In return, we have to obey Him. If we obey Him, we're protected. If we don't, we're punished. Now you see how creation stories and salvation stories are tied together. In the true creation story, our birth is from the stars and we are linked to all life on earth, and all the creative powers in the universe are alive in us and working through us. That's where the power is. That means that our salvation story is to recognize our fundamental identity with the creative powers of the universe. This is an empowering story. In the false creation story, we're not sacred, and we will never hope to be. You get burned at the stake quicker in the Middle Ages by claiming to be God, or by rejecting the story of that tribe, than by doing anything else. Now the most you can hope for is a relationship between humans and God. That's been the salvation story of most Western religions throughout history. We've all been soaked in it, and we tend not to look at it, and I want you to back off and look at it and say, is this really a good story? Of all the ways there are to put together the stories of who we are and how we got here and where our power and what our destiny is that really the best way to do it? And I want to say it is not. It isn't a good creation story, and it isn't true. It's enslaving, not empowering. You can find the original creation story in some ancient religions. It's what Hinduism is about. It's what advanced Hinduism is about. Elementary Hinduism is so different from advanced Hinduism, it's almost like they're different religions to an outsider. The first lesson often in Hinduism is to take students who come in clinging to this or this or this or that or that or that, saying, this is where the center is, this is what's sacred. And Hinduism starts by saying, no, not that, not that, not that. Stop clinging to those things. Those aren't where it's sacred. And yet, the final lesson of Hinduism that I've read is the exact opposite of that. After some enlightenment, the teacher points to the whole world, to the whole universe, to all that ever is or was, and says, that art thou. Atman is Brahman. The drop of water is ocean. That's the original salvation story that comes from the original creation story, and I want to say it's true. It's a story of empowerment. The second creation story is taught by religions that teach obedience rather than empowerment and threaten all who disobey with exclusion or damnation. And I want to say it's not honest. It's not founded in a true creation story, and we need to say that loud and clear. Religious liberals and millions of secular people who reject the biblical creation story are often called heretics in our society, as though they weren't really seeking the truth. But I think the facts show otherwise. It was the ancient Hebrews in Western religion who falsified the real creation story. It seems to have arisen from their boundary disputes with their neighbors, the Canaanites, but they created a creation story that was not true, and a notion of God that disempowered people rather than empowering them, and that gave both power and dignity to the priests who claimed to speak for that God rather than to the people. To the people who guard the walls around the building over the spring rather than the people who could drink freely from the spring. And that habit has continued all the way down to the present day. Power belongs to those who control the story, and if we don't know the true story, we're not likely to have much power or dignity of our own at all. And churches aren't likely to have honest authority either, no matter how many costumes they have. A week ago, I was in Berkeley, and I had a chance to spend some time with an old acquaintance, Dominic Crossan, who was co-founder of the Jesus Seminar. Dom was a Catholic priest. He spent 19 years in a monastery as a scholar. Still looks back on that as a blessing. He said it was just the best education anyone could have found. Then he left the priesthood and married, but remained a Catholic who now fights almost everything the church does, and fights it now on the basis of more than 40 years of biblical scholarship. He spoke of the arrogance of the bishops, the cardinals, and the pope today on the terrible cases of sexual abuse where they want to be regarded as authoritative even when they're wrong. And he said that's the dissociation that's happened from getting the story wrong and getting out of touch with real authority and truth. And then he said, this was my favorite quote of his, he said, "We Catholics are yearning for the days when the worst thing the church did was sell indulgences." The historical note is that the sale of indulgences was what caused the Protestant Reformation 500 years ago. The Catholic Pope, to raise money, started saying, "You know, your mother who just died, she's suffering terribly in purgatory, but you can buy indulgences from the church, which has a huge treasure chest full of them, and then she won't suffer." And when that worked, then they got more creative and said, "You know, your grandmother's suffering too. Actually, they're suffering all the way back." This is what made Luther so angry that he started the split that became the Protestant Reformation. So the sale of indulgences was pretty bad. There are a lot of Catholics who wish that were the worst thing going on now. That's quite a thing for a man who has been a powerful Catholic all of his life to be saying about his church. What Catholics and non-Catholics alike have come to see is that religions that aren't grounded in real truth have no necessary moral or ethical authority. The good news in religion is that you really can't fake it. The other good news is that if you know the truth can make you free. It may not make you popular with members of your tribe, but it can set you free. It may be the only thing that can set you free. This morning, I began a four-part sermon series by telling you what I believe is the true story of creation. You don't have to take my word for it. You can check it out. There's much more to consider in the coming weeks: the nature of human nature, good and evil, the prescription for what ails us. But this was a beginning. Think about the story this week, and about the difference between religious stories that empower you and religious stories that enslave you. If you find yourself feeling a little more free, it's a good sign that you may be a religious liberal, and that is also good news.